tomorrow. Here's Ashley.
Welcome to Thursday. I was waiting for this day. I didn't expect it to come this early, but I was waiting for it because I think like you, was beyond livid when I heard about three young teens, one of them actually, you know, not even a teen, 11, were accused of this. Joyriding around in a stolen car, rolling tape, and spotting a cyclist up ahead. And then saying, yeah, ram him, get him, do it, bump him. And that's what they did. That car, stolen car, 4:30 in the morning, bumped that cyclist who was on his way to work. 63 years old, cherished treasure for Americans because he was a PhD in physics and worked at a lab that helped in homeland security issues. Killed him. This was a story we brought to you not that long ago, and we are getting resolution tonight. We already have a plea bargain. The driver admitting he did it, admitting he's a murderer, admitting it was a stolen car, joyride, they intended to do it. Wait till you hear what that 13-year-old, right? 13 is going to get. And then for good measure, what's going to happen to the 15-year-old who was in the back seat and the 11-year-old in the passenger seat in the front waving a gun? I have the DA for this case on with me tonight because the 11-year-old, it's limbo, man. The law in New Mexico says you cannot charge kids who are under 12. Well, there may be resolution. You're going to hear that in just a moment. Also, I, like you, am sick and tired of being kept in the dark when it comes to American jurisprudence. I love this country. I love it so much. I begged my way in here to this country. Our system of justice is number one in the world. We are transparent. You get a right to a defense, no matter who you are or what you can afford. And we give you a vigorous defense. And if you're guilty, we lock you up. But we often keep it on the record. We are all allowed to know what's going on because it's our system. So every time I hear gag order, close the court, public can't know, I get real antsy because that ain't American to me. I get the reasons why sometimes it's necessary. I just feel like there's a lot of overkill. And this was one of the cases I feel there was overkill, the Delphi case. They locked a man up for the rest of his life. And we didn't really know a lot about the evidence because cameras were, you know, barred from the courtroom and evidence was kept under wraps. But Richard Allen is serving 130 years and we still don't know the evidence. And that changes tonight. Tonight, I'm going to play you the phone calls where he admitted to killing two little girls, where he told his wife over and over he did it, and pictures that we were never allowed to see that the jury did. I'm sharing that tonight. And then also, do you remember the Kim Kardashian robbery in Paris where she was actually tied up, thrown in her bathtub, and like a whole team of thieves made off with her jewels, like over $1 million worth? Yeah, like I had the whole Ocean's 11 in my mind on this one, right? Turns out not so much. The people who are in court talking about this crime, they're more like an ad for like Celebrex or Humira. Wait until you see these guys. There's a reason they're being called the grandpa robbers. You'll see it all. That's coming in just a moment. But let me start here. Do you have any standout memories from when you were 11, like fifth, sixth grade? If you're like me, probably not a whole lot because it was a long time ago. But if you do have some of those memories, they probably revolve around school or sports or siblings. And they probably don't revolve around burglaries, shootings, grand theft auto, and murder. But that is what one 11-year-old might be reminiscing about in the many years to come, if he even makes it into his teens. Since March, we have been following the struggles of police and prosecutors in New Mexico and how to deal with an 11-year-old boy that they've been tailing for quite a while now. He is in the system somewhere in that state tonight, along with two other kids, older kids, all of 13 and 15 when arrested. They were hauled in for the violent death of 63-year-old nuclear physicist Scott Habermill. This happened about a year ago at 4:30 in the morning. Scott was on his way to work at the Sandia National Laboratory, and he was riding his bike. The kids were behind him in a stolen car, and one of them was filming on his phone from the back seat.
Are you guys recording this?
Yeah.
Somebody,
oh,
my
soul.
You ready to start popping? Hurry up with that turn.
They're gonna hit him hella fast. Just bump him, bruh.
Like, just like bump him?
Yeah, just bump him. Go like 15, 20.
We froze the video, obviously. You don't really want to play a man's murder on television. But you can bet what happened next. They didn't just bump him. They ran him right over. And Scott Habermill died. Of course, that video was a big help in tracking the three suspects down. And tonight, we know the fate of at least one of those boys, the 13-year-old, the one who was behind the wheel driving, the one who bumped him. Yeah, I said 13. He had quite a day in court. Was not a trial, because that child, Jonathan Overbay, pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. He also pleaded to leaving the scene of an accident and illegally having a gun. His lawyers struck a deal for him, under which he will stay locked up until he is 21 years old. If you do the math, that is 8 years from now. But you know what else happens at these kinds of deal-makings? Sentencings. And you know what happens when people are sentenced? Victims' loved ones have their say. Here is Scott Habermill's broken-hearted wife, Jamie.
I'm in survival mode, so I feel none of this for the perpetrators of this crime. I go through day to day just hoping to make it through yet another day, and I don't have the ability to feel sympathy, empathy, or compassion for any of the three that put me in this place. So, if they're seeking my forgiveness, they also will not receive that. It's not mine to give. The person that could give it is no longer able to, because he's dead. And they will have to find their forgiveness somewhere else. It will not come from me.
When the news broke in March, it did not bring relief or closure. Instead, it reopened wounds that had barely begun to heal. The revelation that the crash was no accident, it was premeditated murder, brought new pain, anger, confusion, more questions. Why did this happen? How could a human being be capable of taking an innocent cyclist, Scott's, life? We are left to contemplate questions that will never have an answer.
I'm deeply sorry for your loss. I pray for you guys to heal, and I know that there's no excuse for what has happened. Sorry. I can't imagine what you're going through right now, and please just know that me and my son are ready to face the consequences for his actions.
So, 8 years. 8 years for the boy who was driving that stolen car and killed a respected scientist. What about the other two kids? The kid in the backseat who made that video is William Garcia. He was 15. Now he's 16. And prosecutors decided to charge him as an adult. And he is in jail, pending trial, no bail allowed. You won't be going home to mom. The boy in the front passenger seat, the one who was waving the gun, he is the 11-year-old Messiah Hayes. In a better world, Messiah should be in about fifth grade, dreaming about his first crush, maybe a soccer game. But instead, he is in legal limbo. And tonight, he's not charged with this crime. And that is because the law in New Mexico prohibits detaining or prosecuting anyone under the age of 12. But there is one exception, and that is murder. And what is clear as day is that Scott Habermill was murdered. So what will authorities do about this 11-year-old kid? My next guest knows. Sam Bregman is the DA for Bernalillo County, New Mexico, and he's live with me now. DA Bregman, thank you so much for being with me tonight. That's the question. What is going to happen with this 11-year-old?
Of course, and thank you, and it's a pleasure to be on tonight. I will tell you that 11-year-old will be charged with murder. When he turns 12 years old, he will be charged with murder.
So that is what I've been waiting for, is that metric. I believe, if I remember reading a document a while ago, that his birthday is in days or maybe a week or two.
It's in the month of May, and we will be charging him with murder. What you just showed is so devastating and so disgusting and so cruel and so, words cannot express how awful this is. And it's crazy. I mean, we've got an 11-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 15-year-old doing this, and it's so unacceptable. And we don't have a juvenile code in New Mexico that is caught up with the things that we are seeing on the streets of Albuquerque. It's very disheartening. And we need to do everything we can to make sure we hold these young kids accountable when they do something like this and protect the community. And it's extremely frustrating. We just tried recently to amend the juvenile code in New Mexico up the legislature, and we barely even got a hearing. It's really frustrating because times are changing. This isn't about a couple of kids fighting behind the high school anymore. This is about kids who are violently hurting and killing people on the streets of Albuquerque. Listen to this statistic. I've charged 46 kids with murder over the last several years. 46. It's crazy.
46. It's fascinating that you say that he is going to face murder charges, this 11-year-old, and when he turns 12 in the next few days and weeks. Will he face the same process likely as this 13-year-old, meaning he has the opportunity to plead? He may face the same juvenile proceeding. There is no chance for him to be raised to adult court like the 15-year-old, correct?
That's correct. And the same with the 13-year-old. The 13-year-old that pled, the only other charge he could have pled to was first-degree murder, and that would have been the exact same sentence at that age. They cannot be charged as adults. They cannot be kept in past their 21st birthday. It's very disheartening, and things need to change because we need to hold people accountable. And it's pretty tough to tell the family of a victim, like we see here today, that they're all going to be out at 21. Or not all, not the 15-year-old, because he's being charged as an adult.
Yeah, what's the potential for this 15-year-old? I want to keep in mind that the allegations are he's in the back seat. He's rolling video. He's egging on the driver, saying, bump him, go 15 or 20. So I'm looking at what that means for an adult charged with a conspiratorial kind of murder, because that's what this sort of looks like if the allegations are true. What would he be facing? What kind of a sentence would that 15-year-old backseat filmer be facing?
Well, that would be up to a judge, obviously, what type of sentencing. But he's. By the way, he is presumed innocent, 0 to 15, and he is presumed innocent until unless he's proven otherwise in a court of law. And I want to make sure I emphasize that. The individual that's pled guilty, they are obviously guilty of second-degree murder, and they will be until they're 21. I wish we could have extended that longer, but right now that's all that the law provides. We've actually worked a lot on this issue within our office to try and get our legislature to change the laws in our juvenile justice system. And here's the kicker. We haven't updated our juvenile justice laws since before the iPhone was invented, back in 1993. Wow. Okay. Things have dramatically changed. These kids now, as you saw in the front seat showing the gun, they think they're trophies now. The violence amongst young people right now is unacceptable.
Well, and the celebration of it, the posting of it, the laughing, the keeping it a secret for, you know, a year while that man died. And he could have been saved. He could have been saved because once the paramedics found him, he was breathing, he was bleeding, but he could have been saved had someone done something about it. Last quick question. This 11-year-old's background is absolutely jaw-dropping. Police say that he'd been arrested multiple times, just beyond the age of 10, at least two shootings, aggravated assault, burglary, vandalism, organized retail theft, ramming a car into a convenience store to steal alcohol, all of this last summer when he had barely just turned 11. This is a dangerous person, no matter what age he is. And so now we've got this alleged murder that he'll be tried for, as you said, he'll be charged for. But where is he tonight? If he's not being detained, if he is not charged currently, where is he and how do we know we're all safe from him now?
Well, I know where he is, and I'm, you talked about transparency earlier. I would love to get in and talk more about specifics, but I'm not allowed to because of the law in New Mexico forbids me as the district attorney, the prosecutor, from speaking about a child of that age. But I want the people in New Mexico to know that tonight that is not a worry about that. And I just can't disclose more than that. I'm forbidden from doing it. But he will be charged and we'll hold him accountable every single bit under the law as it exists today.
You know what? You and I have to talk again. I think there's so much more to be said, and clearly in the next couple of days. Like I said, I was digging through all the paperwork. I spotted his birthday weeks and weeks ago, and I know it is days away, if not just mere weeks away. So I'm going to call you again, District Attorney Bregman. Thank you for this tonight.
Please do. Thank you.
All right, this is a good opportunity for me to bring in someone I have a great deal of respect for. It's Judge Ashley Wilcott. You've seen her on Court TV. She's a career trial attorney and mediator, also a certified child welfare law specialist. I couldn't wait to get your take on this. So let's just start with what happened today, Ashley. 13 years old, pleading guilty. He'll be locked away till age 21. But is that enough?
Well, no, I don't think it is enough. Ashley, thank you for having me. As always, you know how much I respect what you do in bringing this to light, because here's the reality. You just heard it straight from the district attorney. The laws are such, and the goal was, when we come up with these laws to hold children accountable, they're children. So the whole goal is rehabilitation. And so it's not to say they need to be punished, deterred, they're going to be in prison for 20 years, but rather we're going to put them in a juvenile facility where they can receive rehabilitation so that they can come out a better person, so that while their young brain is developing, they can come out and say, those were bad choices. This is why I'm going to make better choices. The problem is, when you have this heinous of an offense, is that ever going to feel like justice to anyone that he stays in till 21 and he's walking the streets? No, that's not going to feel fair at all.
Now let's talk about the 11-year-old. You just heard the DA making news tonight saying as soon as he turns 12, he will be charged. I wish I could remember his birthday, but it's coming up soon. The question I have for you is, why doesn't the law treat juveniles the same way it treats those with mental ailment? Meaning, if you are not guilty by reason of insanity, you're incarcerated until you are well. And if you are never well, Andrea Yates, I think of, you don't get out. Why isn't the same standard applied to juveniles? You go away until we know you're safe, and then you can get out.
Because again, the entire point of the juvenile system is to rehabilitate. The belief that at the core, kids are kids. They make dumb decisions. They make bad decisions, Ashley. And because of that, and their brain's still developing, there should be a way to treat them and they should get out. They shouldn't spend the rest of their lives in prison. The problem is, when you see these kinds of offenses, it's a whole different kind of offender. It's why the 15-year-old could be tried as an adult, because then it's presumed he has the mens rea, the ability to know in his brain right from wrong, that he's committed a crime, that it's premeditated. And so the problem is, you're seeing kids younger and younger and younger committing these heinous offenses. And I think there are two reasons for that. It's either A, a true mental health issue that needs treatment, or B, parenting. There are problems, whether it's abuse and neglect, trauma, whatever it is, that has messed this kid up so much that they are committing horrific crimes. And maybe they need to be tried as adults at a younger age. That's something our system needs to look at, to the district attorney's point.
Judge, I only have like 30 seconds left, but I have to get you on this just because you know so much about the law as it applies to juveniles. This 11-year-old, the rap sheet is just unbelievable. And I wish I had a better adjective. Shootings, aggravated assault, burglary, vandalism, retail theft, ramming a car into a convenience store to steal alcohol, and now this alleged murder. Is this the kind of 11-year-old that is rehabilitatable?
Not without a lot of help, not without a lot of treatment for a very, very long time. And I would argue that child's been neglected, and that's the reason, right? A parent doesn't allow a child to do that without neglecting them. So there's a parental piece of this as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I know from earlier interviews, and that is that there are no parents. I believe one or both may be dead. One was MIA, the other one died. Another one, it was an aunt or something, tried to keep this kid in and could not hold him. He was just a wild child, so there is some of that. It's great to have you. Thank you for the perspective.
Thank
I'm
you.
Going to ask you back when that charge happens and we can talk more
yes,
about
please.
It then.
Thank you, Ashley.
Ashley Wilcott joining us. Huge fan, Ashley. Thank you for this. Coming up, a fair trial depends on a fair jury, right? And one way to seat a fair jury is not to pick people who have personal connections with people involved in the case. No brainer. That was certainly the rule for Karen Reed and her juries, but not so much maybe for the judge. What's with the judge's connection to the players in the case? And is it just a problem that all smaller towns face? Going to dig into that deep next. Everybody knows our name, but in court, doesn't work that way. If you have ever shown up for jury duty, you know that one of the questions you're asked is if you know anybody in the courtroom. Or if you're connected to any of the players in the case. And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If you know the defendant or his lawyer, you might go easy on him. And if you know the prosecutor, you might give her the edge. So it is a bit of a head scratcher as to why so many of the players in the Karen Reed case know each other. And it doesn't seem to matter, especially when it comes to the judge. Months before Karen Reed went on trial, her defense lawyer accused the judge of bias because of connections that the judge had to some of the players in the case. And you should know right away that the judge, Beverly Cannone, was having none of it. She refused to step aside, and that was that. But here is why Karen's lawyers were worried. Judge Cannone's brother is a lawyer. His name is John Prescott Jr. And a long time ago, in the mid-1990s, John Prescott Jr., represented a man named Chris Albert. Chris Albert killed a student in a hit-and-run crash and spent 30 hours on the run from the police. But Chris Albert was caught and went on to serve 6 months behind bars. Chris Albert also has a brother, and that brother's name is Brian Albert. Brian is a retired cop who owned the home located at 34 Fairview Road in the town of Canton. And that's the house where John O'Keefe was found frozen out on the front lawn after a house party in January of 2022. Prosecutors say Karen Reed hit him with her SUV. But Karen's lawyers say someone at that house party beat him to death and framed Karen. So you can see why the connections kind of matter here. And there is more where that came from. Jennifer McCabe is a star witness for the prosecution. And Jen McCabe has a sister. That sister is married to Brian Albert, again, homeowner during that fateful house party. And you had better believe that Karen Reed's attorney, Alan Jackson, is not letting go of any of this. In cross-examination, Alan Jackson played up the fact that Brian Albert, the homeowner, was there when the police first interviewed Jen McCabe, star witness. And remember, Jen was at that party that night. And Jen also was there the next morning and helped to find O'Keefe's body. Brian Albert, homeowner, was also one of the five people that Jen McCabe called right away, right before her interview with the feds. Even though she only admitted to calling two people and Brian Albert was not on that list. As for what really happened to John O'Keefe that night, defense lawyer Alan Jackson went for Jen McCabe's jugular, pointing out that she said one thing to a grand jury and said something else twice now during trial.
I remembered she said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him. I called Officer Lank.
And your memory is getting better even as we sit here today, correct?
There are certain things I will never forget, Mr. Jackson.
Including the fact that you never, ever, ever said, she said the words I hit him to a grand jury when you were asked about it 3 months after the incident, correct?
She said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
You never told that to the grand jury, did you?
I don't remember specifically that every grand jury and everything I said, but I can tell you with 100% accuracy, she screamed, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
So Jen McCabe stuck to her story, and she kept her cool, too. Actually, she kept her cool a lot better in this trial than she did in the last trial. But when the court day was over, Karen Reed did not hold back either.
It's just more of the same inconsistencies. Every statement's different. Under oath, not under oath, with the cops are all wrong. This is very similar to what we saw a year ago.
Do you think that she colluded with
why? Why is she so inconsistent?
Because she's lying.
Jen McCabe will be back on the stand tomorrow, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor Mark Iglarsh has a thing or two to say about this trial. Let's start with the tangled web part, because this is the thing I just can't believe, although I guess I need to believe it, because not every town is Boston or New York or L.A. where nobody knows each other. A lot of towns, literally the whole town knows each other, and you got to pick a jury somewhere.
Right. All right. Once again, I don't share your same emotion for this issue, but there is merit to your argument, the argument that the defense is making, because at a minimum, it gives people like you and others watching this trial the image of impropriety. Hey, judge, why don't you just let one of the other judges handle this? One whose brother wasn't involved with one of the witnesses, etc. That said, if this ends in conviction, I'm fairly certain from what I've heard, this will not then lead to reversal solely because the judge has that connection that you described.
Oh, you're saying that it's not an appellate issue, that this isn't something that's ripe to bring up for an appeal?
Anything could be an appellate issue. The question becomes, and the judge knows that, the question becomes whether an appellate court is going to reverse potentially a murder conviction because of the facts that you brought out that candidly, we need some type of chart to follow. But ultimately, when I analyzed it, it doesn't rise to the level where I think the appellate court's going to say, no, she should have recused herself.
Boy, that's bizarre. I always think if you're going to go to prison potentially for decades, it has to be so squeaky clean. But like I said,
sometimes the judge knows
everyone.
No, it doesn't always have to be squeaky clean. In fact, I found with a number of my cases, the appellate court can say, all right, error was committed, but it wasn't enormous. It wasn't enough to really change the outcome. And so the judge, you know, they could say, well, we find that the judge should have considered recusing herself to avoid the image of impropriety. We don't believe that that resulted in fundamental unfairness where the defendant needs a new trial.
So the other question I have for you, Mark, so many people are invested in the Karen Reed case. It's so incredible. Like, it's overseas, it's across the country. And a lot of people became interested in trial number two because of, you know, the docuseries on it. But the interesting thing is that it felt when this second trial started that that was it. Game over. First two witnesses, Karen Reed's done, she's guilty. Why is it that people need to hold their horses?
Because what we have going on here with these really talented defense lawyers is what I'm calling a courtroom cha-cha, where the prosecution witnesses take us one step forward and then the defense goes one step back or two steps back. The witness says, she said, I hit her. I hit. And then all of a sudden, well, wait a second. You didn't say it here. And yes, your testimony was a little different. So it's one step forward, two step back. And I think that this is really going to highlight the importance of why that forensic evidence is key. That doesn't lie. That's not subject to interpretation. That will either corroborate the state's case or not.
I love courtroom cha-cha because it's just such a perfect visual experience of what happens. It's like a pendulum, a cha-cha. But how much doubt is reasonable? And I know that's a really tough answer, but I'm just going to ask you for it.
Yeah, I don't know yet that you've got it here. I think this prosecutor is doing a fairly good job of focusing more on the forensic evidence. Plus, I thought bringing the decedent's mother to the stand to add that emotional testimony, it's what prosecutors love. They live for it. They had her on the stand, and boy, she was likable. It was raw emotion. If you've got the forensic evidence to show that she backed her vehicle up at 24.2 miles an hour, which is exactly what they're claiming, and that the other forensic evidence corroborates what these witnesses are saying, then she's going to get what she deserves.
Well, we'll see, because I think you'll agree with me here, and I'm just going to go out on a limb, that Alan Jackson is an incredible lawyer. And if anybody can do it, I think
Alan can do that. I would absolutely concede that.
Keep the tape, everybody. Iglarsh is agreeing. Hey, Mark, thanks
on that point,
for being on. I appreciate it.
Take care.
I'll see you again soon. Okay, still to come in this show. In this new age of judges banning the public from seeing things in court, like witnesses and videotape and actual testimony, sometimes we have to wait to finally see the evidence for ourselves. And such is the case with the Delphi murders. We were banned from seeing so many things before Richard Allen was convicted of killing Abby Williams and Liberty German, but not anymore. Up next, the jaw-dropping things that Richard said to his wife on tape and the images that led that jury to lock him up. Were tried in the court of public opinion almost from the moment they happened in February of 2017. Abigail Williams, who was 13, and her best friend Liberty German, 14, were attacked and killed while hiking near an abandoned railway bridge in the heart of Indiana. It took investigators 5 years to home in on a suspect, and I do mean home. The man they arrested was a Delphi pharmacy tech known to pretty much everybody in town. But was Richard Allen really the infamous bridge guy, or wasn't he? Evidence shown to the public consisted mainly of a short, grainy video clip from one of the victim's phones. But at trial, the jury that convicted Richard Allen saw hundreds of exhibits. Exhibits that we, the public, did not see because cameras were barred from the courtroom. And those exhibits have stayed pretty much under wraps until now. Our News Nation affiliate in Indianapolis got a hold of some of that evidence, and reporter Max Lewis takes us through it.
Cameras were banned from the Delphi courtroom where Richard Allen was tried and ultimately found guilty for the 2017 murders of Abby Williams and Libby German. We requested hundreds of exhibits from this trial, but only received a fraction of them. Still, it's the first time they're being seen outside the courtroom.
The actual crime scene photos remain sealed in the case, but this diagram shown to the jury is what it looked like. Libby German's naked body next to Abby Williams, both covered with tree branches. Their bodies found on February 14, 2017, along Deer Creek in Delphi. Police would ultimately focus their attention on Allen after discovering an interview he gave shortly after the murders, saying he was on the trails that day. That led to a search of Allen's home, where newly public photos show his black Ford Focus in the garage, the same one prosecutors say that was seen on surveillance cameras near the trail that day. Inside his home, investigators found numerous knives, including box cutters, which is believed to have been the murder weapon. Police also found this blue Carhartt jacket, similar to the one the bridge guy was wearing the day the girls were killed. But detectives say the big find was his six-hour P226, which a firearms examiner later connected to an unspent bullet found at the crime scene. The startling find was this Winchester 40 caliber bullet inside a memory box, the same type of ammunition found between the girls' bodies. Prosecutor Nicholas McClellan called it the bridge guy starter pack.
I think maybe I'm losing my mind, but I'm not sure. I need you to know that I did this.
What? No, you didn't, dear. There's no way. There's no way, dear.
Love me.
We've also obtained the phone calls Allen made from the Westville prison in which he confessed to killing the girls. It was during this time the doctors also determined Allen was going through a period of psychosis.
I just wanted to apologize to you.
What's going on, sweetheart?
I did it.
You did
no,
what?
I did it.
What?
I killed Abby. I killed Abby and Libby.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Now, of course, there's a lot more exhibits than what we were able to show you on here. You can find them as well as all of our coverage on the Delphi murders trial over on our website, cbs4indy.com. In the newsroom, I'm Max Lewis, CBS 4 News.
And our thanks to Max Lewis for that. You know, these days, we just assume that every time someone does something bad, it's caught on video. But that was not always the case, certainly not in the early 1990s. If it weren't for a man on a balcony who just so happened to see Los Angeles police beating up a drunk driving suspect in 1991, and if that witness hadn't owned a camcorder, the world might never have heard the name Rodney King, and Los Angeles might not have erupted into that. Today marks a huge milestone for that famous 9-minute grainy video. Video that changed America forever. Our True Crime Rewind is next. Any guesses how long we've had police body cams? It's hard to remember when we didn't, but believe it or not, they didn't show up in this country until 2012, just 13 years ago. And for comparison, the iPhone came out in 2007. Pre-body cam, the details of a traffic stop or a highway chase or a takedown were pretty much whatever the cops involved said they were, unless, of course, there was like an independent witness somewhere. But way back in 1991, camcorders were a thing, just barely. And let me tell you, not everyone had one. But George Holliday did. He lived in LA, and when he happened to notice some police getting rough, like really, really, really rough with a guy that they'd pulled over, he started rolling his camcorder. The man whom officers were beating and tasing and stomping and striking with batons, that was Rodney King. And Holliday's grainy video lasted 9 minutes and 20 seconds. It became the star witness in the 1992 trial of four of those officers. But those cops were acquitted 33 years ago this week. And a huge number of Angelenos were outraged. 3 hours after the verdict, riots broke out in South Central and spread from there into some of the most jaw-dropping chaos that that city has ever seen. And our News Nation affiliate, KTLA, was live for all of it.
You are watching continuing coverage of LA Under Siege here on KTLA Channel 5 in Los Angeles.
April 30th, 1992. The KTLA Morning News is less than a year old, and we're covering the story of a city that is out of control.
We have not moved. Police have left. And these looters, the people are coming in here again in large numbers, taking what they see left in these stores that have been destroyed or heavily damaged, and it's like a festival. I don't know how else to describe it.
Are there no officers there, Warren, at all?
No, there are no officers here now. They were here earlier, but they had to be called to another location after they cleared this out.
It's a free-for-all as people loot and burn businesses in South Central LA.
How many people will it take to stop this?
On the morning after the four cops involved in the Rodney King beating were acquitted.
And you see a lot of people running around here in the parking lot. They have broken the windows to a sporting goods store, which is very frightening because you imagine that there might be weapons inside there.
For our crews on the ground that morning, it was downright dangerous.
There are some very angry feelings among this crowd. In fact, we've had to get up on top of our truck to broadcast to you because they wouldn't let us get through and get pictures.
But we did get pictures of one man who refused to just watch while the city burned.
What we are doing is standing on the roof of an apartment, and with this gentleman here, telling me, what, sir, you're fighting here. Why are you fighting here by yourself with your water hose?
Trying to help my people, brother.
More looting going on.
The chaos continued all day. Black columns of smoke filled the sky until National Guard troops rolled in later on, the first of 4,000 who would patrol the streets. And by the next morning, we were finally seeing a sign of hope.
This is a group of people who are cleaning up, and it's a spontaneous group of people. They're carrying brooms. They've got dumpsters that they're rolling along south.
Man, that video. Today's May 1st, right? And on May 1st of that year, 33 years ago, an emotional Rodney King gave an impromptu news conference outside of his lawyer's office and made this now infamous plea.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along?
I should have said famous plea. It's not an infamous plea. It was a famous plea. The major rioting stopped that day, but some smaller riots continued. Active duty military stayed in the city until May 9th to keep the peace. The National Guard stayed until the 14th. All told, the riots resulted in 63 deaths, more than 2,000 injuries, and 12,000 arrests. And property damage topped $1 billion. Again, 33 years ago, $1 billion. Coming up, what do these men have in common? A love of crossword puzzles? Misspelled cards on grandparents' day? It turns out they've all spent a little time in Kim Kardashian's hotel room, or so the police say, and left with some pretty pricey souvenirs. Details are next of the grandpas on the stand. Grandpa robbers. That's what the French are calling 10 defendants, most of them in their 60s and 70s, who are on trial for allegedly robbing Kim Kardashian at a Paris hotel in 2016. You will probably remember that Kim was tied up and forced into a bathtub while a gaggle of these people made off with more than $10 million worth of her jewelry. At the time, we thought they were thugs, but honestly, I don't think thugs really describe the suspects. Old folks, I think, was a better description for the suspects. Police rounded them up. One has since died. Another has dementia. And yesterday, the alleged head grandpa was on the stand, and his testimony was a real struggle. Old Omar, as he's known, is almost entirely deaf and unable to speak. So the lawyers had to type up his questions, and he had to write out his answers. Old Omar actually confessed to tying Kim up and leaving her in the bathtub, but he denied that he was the ringleader. Police managed to recover a